Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you.
interview by telephone Dr. Jones helped write the speech. Then we will hear four speech excerpts in the order that Dr. King said them. We will hear his opening, and we will hear his closing. And we have two excerpts in the middle of the speech. There will be a panel discussion of these first, middle, and ending sections after each section. One of these middle excerpts is a video clip. Everything else is audio, but there is one video clip. Video clip is the only known video clip of this speech to exist. There is no video or film of this event beginning to end that we know of, and we've searched far and wide. At the time we were doing National Press Lunch in the 60s, we only recorded them. We did not film them all as we do today. So while there is no video of the entirety of the speech, and we are not able to play for you the entirety of the speech in the Q&A because that would take too long, I want you to know that the audio of the entire speech is on our website at press.org/MLK. That's press.org/MLK. You will also see there a printed transcript of this entire event beginning to end. If you have any questions, feel free to access that and learn a lot more about this speech after tonight. After we hear the clips and discuss them, Joe will interview journalist Bruce Johnson, and then Joe will close the program promptly at 9 p.m. One of the most significant things to ever happen at the National Press Club. And to mark the significance of this event, and let me tell you, it's long past due, we've made a plaque that we're bringing up for the first time here. Right at the beginning of the presidency, we were going to do this. We're going to put this plaque right outside these doors of the ballroom, just to the left. There's a photo of LBJ and Nixon there right now. LBJ and Nixon are just going to get moved. They're not going to go away, but they are going to get moved because that is a highly prominent spot to have observed that this highly significant event happens, and that plaque will be at the National Press Club, which really is a living museum. If you walk around and look at the walls, that plaque will be there as long as the Press Club stands. And while I am only president for another week, believe me, back and do not see that plaque anywhere, there will be nonviolent direct action to make sure that that plaque is returned. And I don't think anybody's ever going to move it, frankly, because we're all in awe of what we're all going to hear tonight. And I heard some of the excerpts earlier this afternoon, and then it was done. Without further ado, I want to introduce Joe Madison. Thank you.
For more than half a century, Simeon Booker devoted his career to in journalism. The stories that he and his fellow black journalists told and the things they encountered are put in a biography. In putting the panel together, the first thing we had to do was make sure that all the participants were alive and here with us. And when you consider it's been 50-plus years, we wanted to dig deep and get people understood exactly what went on. It was interesting. The National Press Club, the very first speaker, as you heard, was African-American speaker, was Martin Luther King Jr. And you begin to wonder why it takes long to have the 1962. You could have had Jackie Robinson, Thurgood Marshall, Marian Anderson. The list goes on and on and on. Booker T. Washington. And then you realize that they didn't admit their first woman to the Press Club in 1961. So we've come a long way, and the person who has watched that journey is Simeon Booker. Simeon Booker, ladies and gentlemen, if you don't know, Jet Magazine would not be Jet Magazine without that Simeon Booker piece. And so, and his wife, Carol, is right beside him, and let's give her a round of applause for the work that she has done. Now, Simeon, first of all, thanks for being here. Second, and let's get to this. You were on the committee that actually decided Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to be the speaker. And to the best of your recollection, what went on in that meeting? What was it like? And Carol, if you can fill in, because I know you have, there's an extensive paragraph in his autobiography about that meeting. But what do you remember, Jimmy?
Two hearing aids.
Okay.
It's a challenge. What do you remember about the decision to invite Dr. King? Do you remember some tension on the speakers committee? But he did remember when he wrote the book. So he's asked me to
read that and maybe it might jar his memory.
At 97, memory fades with every day.
But this chapter in that book, yes.
It is. This is from Sean, a reporter wrote in 2013. It's published by University Press of Mississippi, ironically. But he writes that he remembered the first time that Dr. King spoke at the club in 1962. Simeon was only the second member of the club, the African-American speaker. But Louis didn't participate. And when Simeon was sponsored for membership, he was urged to be an active member. And he was. He joined the Speakers Committee, which was one of the most important committees because it was the committee that chose speakers on newsmaker luncheons here at the club. So he was Dr. King. Now, Dr. King had gotten some notoriety, a lot of press because of the Montgomery bus. He had never been interviewed by the National Press. And Simeon thought the time had come. It was a year before the March on Washington and the I Have a Dream speech. And it was 2 years before Dr. King became the youngest recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize. So he still had not been named by Magazine Man of either. So Jet Magazine has had Dr. King on its cover at least twice. And if you know the history of Jet Magazine, the cover was usually a young starlet, a pretty young woman. Here was a newsmaker taking the cover. It was very unusual for publishing. And King had never addressed a large audience of the national press. Also at the same time in 1962, maybe even earlier, but in 62 at least, the FBI itself will admit J. Edgar Hoover had targeted Dr. King as a possible pawn of the communist movement in America, as anybody who participated in civil rights at that time was suspect by the FBI as being not only a troublemaker, but possibly a pawn of the movement. J. Edgar Hoover used the press, people that he knew, to send out rumors. And I think it might have been that more than any racial issue that caused dissension on
the committee.
The committee
to invite him.
Yes,
to
speak. The chairman of the committee resigned to protest when the committee accepted Simeon's recommendation that Dr. King speak.
The chairman of the speakers committee.
Yeah. So it was maybe the only one. But the speech itself, as we'll get to later on, is a massive speech. You can tell I followed it, that the seed had been planted, because there is one question about whether it had been written by Stanley Levinson, a New York lawyer who was considered by the FBI to be communist-tainted.
Is it now not maybe I can't get close to this microphone, so if you would translate, is there anything, Simeon, that you've heard that you want to add, or did Carol pretty much get your thoughts there that you put down in the book? If you can.
Can you hear Joe? Can you hear him?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you add my brilliant summary. Remember, we're going home together tonight.
We'll keep talking.
I got creepy when I first walked into his office many years ago. Keep talking. Just keep talking. Right.
Sometimes it's better if I'm not in the room, because then he'll talk. But if I'm here, he'll say, oh, you do it. Now, come on, Simeon. Talk a bit.
You will
talk a bit.
But
it's tough, after all. You don't realize. People will ask Simeon, when he was on the Freedom Ride, how did he feel in the back of that bus when people were being beaten up? And he'd say, you know, I don't remember. And 50 years later, even the most vivid events kind of pall, especially when there's one event after another.
If you don't mind, I'll tell you what I want to do, and that is to go to Stanford University. I've had the pleasure of interviewing him on several occasions. He was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s advisor, his lawyer, and by the way, his speechwriter. And it was by chance that we discussed this program that I mentioned we were doing this. Carol and Simeon, and he said, Joe, I helped write that speech. And that is Dr. Clarence Jones, who is a scholar in residence at Stanford University at the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute. And Dr. Jones, no, I'm way away, but can you hear me? Dr. Jones Brown. We've given somewhat of the background of how this came about. So let me ask you, just how important was this speech to Dr. King at the time?
Let me just state for the record that the speech was fundamentally his speech, but it was, we had a lot of discussion about it, provided some drafts, the material he should consider when joining them was Stanley Levinson. So the FBI, Stanley Levinson and I played a big role in preparing the text of the speech. I had a rather cynical attitude toward his planned appearance.
Why was that?
In the 1960s, involved in a campaign and desegregate the Albany, Georgia public facilities. Dr. King King had been in and out of Georgia. And someone, I don't think he said, but someone said to me, you know, that I don't think that there's ever a Negro that has spoken at the National Press Club. And I said, I find that hard to believe, but I guess it is. And so I called up Louis Martin, who was on the Democratic National Committee.
Louis Martin was,
at that time, in my opinion, the highest ranking black in the Democratic Party. And so I said, Louis, Martin appears here. He said, yeah. I said, well, how come? I said, well, the Kennedy administration, you got Pierre Salinger, the press secretary, you got
Well, let me ask. let me ask one final question for me, and then if you could expound a couple more minutes. And that's okay. What was Dr. King's reaction after the speech? How did he feel the reception was? Did he, what was his thought after this historic speech?
But it's interesting because I asked him, I said, well, how would you continue to do this?
Is not segregation and discrimination will be eliminated.
Development. He is president of SNCC's Legacy Board. And I'm always so intimidated when I get around Cortland because, one, he's just a brilliant individual. Let's look at your initial reaction.
People went to jail. We were going to fill the jails. People were beginning to really, you know, deal with it, direct action. That Dr. King, all of that is not only South, but Jack Hoover, the distrust of, in some respects, of the Kennedy administration. He came here and made such an opening statement. He was able to be affable. He was able to not really give you the sense of frustration that Dr. Jones talked about. And I think that was King's big contribution to America. When America needed to see a face of what was going on, the question that was always asked, what do you Negroes want? That was the question that was always asked. And King to face all that he faced in the South and come here knowing
that he was the first,
and
as you pointed out,
Thurgood Marshall.
And other people,
not because they didn't make any contributions, but because of the ignorance that people had, for him to come here and to be so gracious and to be so good about his opening, I think.
And I was told to let you know, Cortland, that she was here before you were and on time. They've got a thing going.
Speaking of a Negro first.
A former staff member with in the 1960s and one of the most outstanding documentarians, and to her credit, she worked on the 14-hour Eyes on the Prize that won an Academy Award and the PBS series. Cortland talks about, how Dr. King here was gracious, affable. I made a note, the first attempt at humor in the first part of the speech seemed to fall flat. I mean, they didn't, unless there were a few jokes there, they just didn't respond. And I assume they just didn't get it. I don't know what they were expecting, but they didn't get it. But let's talk about Albany. What was going on in Albany? Now, you're older now, more mature. But at the time, also had major confrontations with SNCC at that time in Albany. I mean, I read a comment by my good friend, the late, great Julian Bond, who referred to Dr. King as the Lord. You know about that, because King didn't even bring that into the discussion, did he, here in the speech?
No, in fact, when they asked him, what is there about the conflict?
Yes.
He deliberately said, we had no conflict.
Really?
And because on the ground organizing, we didn't have on the ground organizing, SCLC, Dr. King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference,
NAACP, right?
And particularly the youth groups of the NAACP, particularly the rural areas where the NAACP had ambassadors, and all the leadership, there was no problem. They had a different organizing style. Dr. King was this incredible intelligence, but he was also a charismatic leader. And so what we would say is that we were doing grassroots leadership from the bottom up. So when I think about Albany, not only of Dr. King and his spending time in jail, I think of Mama Dolly, who nurtured us, who protected us with her 12-gauge in Albany,
now,
Georgia. Mama Dolly is one of the many women in Albany, Georgia, and Terrell County. We used to call it Terrible Terrell, that was near right and all the people, Bernie Sanders, who is the founder of Sweet Honey in the Rock, primary at the Smithsonian for years, she comes out of that Albany, Georgia movement. And that youth movement was the absolute engine that came through in Albany. But the thing we see is a leadership locally that was even our death. So that the main thing was, you're not the leader. You are building leadership from the ground up, and we were building leadership among those who normally would not have had a voice. So when I look at, for example, now considering for the fact that Eyes on the Prize, all 14 hours, hello, is about to come on Sunday on the World Channel, Sunday, just before Downton Abbey, Sunday at 8 p.m., the first one will be at 7:30 with a 30-minute wraparound. And I've been working with WCBA tomorrow, 1 hour, with the teachers around how you teach Eyes on the Prize and the expansion of democracy that we really talk about in Eyes on the Prize. But it's all 14 hours. Now, a lot of stations don't get it, don't get the world, but starting in February, it will go system-wide on PBS. Again, all 14 hours. So it's not just until sit-ins, freedom rides. You get into that second hour, you hear Dr. King in speeches. That last, there's the fourth hour of the second series where it's all devoted to him and where he's talking against the Vietnam War. You see the Riverside speech. The matter when he talks about the fact that he didn't hold the nation one encounters, but now what we need is a radical redistribution of economic power. You see where he is now, which is incredible. But then you see he's going into Chicago in the second series of Eyes on the Prize. You see it in footage. You see it with the people who are interviewed. And you see him going and trying to take that nonviolent action north of Chicago and button it. And what happens when you go into north racism and that entrenched stuff?
But let me ask, how did the, and feel free to jump in, how did the media, the press respond to this? Because one of the things, Carol, is we now have Eyes on the Prize thanks to you.
And others.
But the reality is a lot of young people here think that it was constant news coverage, that it, the news coverage was constant. But that was not the case. It wasn't constant news coverage, was it? And Lord knows you weren't getting a tremendous amount of news in the Southern campaign.
But you had the black press that was following.
Really? Explain the importance of the black press that
you
was following.
We had a very divided at the time. And I'm going to talk about the Washington, D.C. of 1952.
Okay.
African Americans couldn't eat at any of the restaurants near here. We couldn't stay in any of the hotels. My mother and father came here in graduate school. And my father said there was nowhere he could eat except the Supreme Court and the Methodist building when working at the Library of Congress. Of course, we never stayed in hotels in Washington.
Where did you stay?
We stayed with hotels. Anywhere. The Green Book, which told you, Mr. Green told you where you could stay, where you could eat, in D.C., in the North, in the South, in Puerto Rico, in the Bahamas, and in Mexico.
So did Dr. King carry a Green Book around? I mean, I guess
everyone had to carry at least a contact or a phone. When we left here, going to North Carolina, when I saw the Iwo Jima Bridge as a four-year-old, I knew that meant no more bathrooms. No more restaurants, no more film stations. And we could take our lunch from here and use the facilities of our friends in Petersburg and eat the lunch.
So how, tie that into the significance of then Dr. King being invited in July of 60, cousin. Whatchamacallit's house.
Right.
I mean,
1962 is the
significance of it.
1962 is the same year that the Cosmos Club rejected Karl Rowan for membership.
In 1962, the Washington Post had ads both for whites and blacks.
The only place we could go, the restaurant we could go, I remember, there were, I think, maybe three restaurants that black people could go. Into Clifton Terrace. Roy Chalk said you couldn't have any black bus drivers because they would steal the money. I mean, you know, this town, you know, we know was ruled by the Southern, I think McMillan and the people from the South, the town of people from the South. So there wasn't only the press club itself was part of the, one of the first things I did here when I came to Washington, D.C., is picketed RFK Stadium because they had no black people on the register. So I know Washington, and so basically when King came here, what John's talking about is what we all face, whether we lived here or whether we were traveling.
So what Simeon did,
Simeon
to walk into the committee.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
In this town, it wasn't just the press club. It was the whole environment, the whole society that was closed to the black community. And Simeon to take that
national organization, the American Bar Association, did not accept blacks. The American Medical Association did not accept blacks. The American Dental Association didn't accept blacks. And therefore, we had a parallel universe organization, by attorney.
All right, let me do this. We've got a video clip you're going to see, and then an audio clip that you will hear. So let's play those, if you don't mind, right now, the video.
Plunges deeper into the quest for freedom. he will plunge even deeper into the philosophy of nonviolence. As a result, passionately and unrelentingly for our first-class citizenship, but we must never use second-class methods to gain it. As I have said so often, we must never succumb to the temptation of using violence in our struggle. And our chief legacy to the future will be an endless reign of meaningless chaos. The nonviolent resistors can summarize their message in the following simple terms. Without waiting for the agents to act, we will not obey unjust laws or submit to unjust practices. We will do this peacefully and openly, because our aim is to persuade. We adopt nonviolence because our aim is to create at peace with itself. We will try to persuade with our words, but if our words fail, we will try to persuade with our acts. We will always be willing to talk and seek fair compromise, but we are ready to suffer when necessary.
Whoa. Let me tell you what my, I didn't get a chance to properly introduce him, but I will, and that is Dr. John W. Frank, Director of Partnership and International Programs from the National Museum of African American History and Culture, that gorgeous building you see going up over there. And, of course, his father, John Hope Franklin, and for the autobiography of Buck Over Franklin. And he also served as advisor on the documentary film Tutu and Franklin, A Journey Towards Peace. And I got to tell you, Dr. Franklin, to speak before. I mean, there were so many applause lines that I was, you know, I'm listening that today, I mean, people would have been on their feet. Think what we just heard from Cortland and heard from you and the others. Washington was. The establishment was segregated. And he gave that kind of speech. I mean, am I over-exaggerating this, Dr. Franklin?
Not at all. But we grew up being able to function in the black community, and he went to Boston University, so he can function in white academia. Washington academia was as big as any other at the time. I asked my father what were the issues when he arrived here in 1947, and he said the big question in the city was, would George Washington University lives in the be open for everyone? And the answer during his lifetime here was no. It remained a segregated facility. So universities, the universities that we see now, Georgetown, American University, George Washington, were exclusively white institutions. Maryland College Park, my father's a professor there in 19. Demands to meet with the history department to ask, who are these Negroes moving in? Why are they coming? How long are they staying? And how many children did they have? So I went into a hostile. I didn't get it. No one spoke to us. I lived in hostile New York, but I had not experienced.
So what was the significance, Cortland and Judy, what came out of this?
What's amazing to me is that King was 33 years old.
He was what?
33.
Okay.
Think of another 33-year-old person who not only faced what Judy talked about and what John was talking about, Simeon, but and you talk about the hostile environment, message and a strategy and a way of approaching that so that we would move forward as opposed to beginning to move. When you think of the brilliance of King at 33 years old, and he had already been on the scene for at least 8 years, so my sense is that I think when people understand, think about SNCC and King and so forth, you know, I was in 62, I was 21 years old. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not going to call Tim Jenkins' name, but it does seem to me that what America has to appreciate, not only in terms of King, but in terms of the whole generation of people who are ranging from 17, 18 years old to, you know, King being at the outer limits of 33, a whole strategy, a story, a rhetoric that was able to move this country from where it had been to where it needed to go. And that is something that people need to really appreciate, the genius of that group of people that made the difference.
And I wonder, because I would assume at that time, most of the members of were journalists. I mean, they were columnists. They were journalists. But you know, I just wonder what the impact was after the after that speech.
They were
not in that room.
They were not in that room.
Go ahead.
But when
yes.
you talk about, when John talks about the alternate universe.
Yes.
One of the things that you get amazed about with Dr. King, and you see it throughout, and it's what allowed, even though we may have had different organizations,